This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We eat every day. Most of us ingest three meals a day, and most of us don't give much thought to what it is we're eating. Many of us have moved away from feeding ourselves and our families the way grandma used to. I mean, look at all the modern conveniences that have entered the food world in the last several decades. We have a plethora of restaurant choices, and just think of all those microwavable delicacies waiting for us in the frozen food aisle. But wait. If we thought about it, if we knew more about those foods, would we really want to eat them? Michael Pollan refers to many of those foods as edible food-like substances. Do we really want to eat edible food-like substances? Probably not. The alternative, of course, is to remaster the art of cooking, or as Pollan suggests, put down the menus and pick up a spatula. Cooking, he says, can change your life. But don't take my word for it. We'll let him tell you himself, because Michael Pollan, who has been writing books and articles about this for 25 years, including the New York Times bestsellers Food Rules and Eater's Manual and In Defense of Food and Eater's Manifesto, is with us for the hour. Michael Pollan, welcome to the program. Welcome to Charlotte.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here.
Latest book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. We'll get into that as we go through the program. And, of course, our chef on assignment, Dr. Peter Reinhart, Johnson and Wales University, is with us as well. Good morning, Peter.
Thanks. Good to see you again.
First and foremost, Michael, you are a journalist and a journalism professor at UC Berkeley. What made you devote so much of your time, your research, and your writing to food?
Well, I didn't set out to become someone who writes about food. I really set out to write about nature and the environment. And that was my first book. It was a book called Second Nature. And that was the kind of, those are the issues that engage me, our peculiar relationship with nature. And the fact we have a relationship with nature, every other creature just in nature. But as I worked on that, I realized that our most powerful engagement with the natural world comes through our eating. We change the world more through our eating choices than anything else we do. If you think about it, the landscape has been worldwide has been completely remade by agriculture. The composition of species on the planet is really very much the result of what do we eat, what don't we eat. So in this country, we have 100 million head of cattle and 10,000 wolves left because we eat the cattle and the wolves threaten our cattle. And then now we're learning that the climate is affected more by the food system than any other single industry. The way we farm today is contributing more greenhouse gas than the way we transport ourselves or heat our homes. So if you're interested in nature and how we engage with the natural world, you've got to pay attention to what you eat. And that's kind of what got me into it. And then once I got there, I started thinking about everything from nutrition and food science to the politics of food. And here I still am. I mean, I guess I've written now 3 or 4 books on food. And it's a very interesting subject because it connects, you know, we do, as you said in your intro, we eat at least three times a day, many of us eating a lot more than that now. And it has a huge bearing on our health, too, as well as the health of the planet. Mm.
You've done a real 180 on food, evidently. I don't know whether it's because you've grown up or because you've found out more about food and written about it, because you told New York Magazine that you used to love Stouffer's fried chicken and their turkey dinners, and you loved yodels. You loved TV dinners.
I could eat a box of yodels after school, almost every day.
I mean, you were a kid back then, but if you grow up with that food and turn out like you, there must be some reason for hope, right?
There's always reason for hope, Mike. You know, I was a conventional eater, and I love fast food. In those days, when I was growing up in the 60s, you didn't have it several times a day. You know, the average American child, 1 in 3 of all American kids will eat fast food today. I mean, so it's much more ubiquitous than it was. When I was a kid, it was very special to go to McDonald's.
Yes.
It was a big deal.
And
TV dinners, which you were referring to, I loved, but only had those on the Saturday nights that my parents went out. They would make us a TV dinner, and it was a great treat. But for me, the transformation came when I was writing The Omnivore's Dilemma, which is really my first book on food, which is I got curious about where the food comes from and realized at a certain point that I and most Americans had no idea that the food system had been changed more in the last 30 or 40 years than we realized, and probably more than in the last 10,000 years.
In what way?
Well, you know, the images used to sell food still look kind of pastoral, picket fencey, small farms, but the reality is very different. And you now have, in this state particularly, you have huge hog confinement operations where hogs never go outside, and the sows live in crates where they can't even turn around. And, you know, this highly industrialized, factory-based, highly efficient system that nobody wants to show on their packages, because if people could see these places, they would change the way they eat. I've had occasion to visit those places and be on feedlots in Kansas, cattle feedlots and hog confinement here in North Carolina, and also potato, you know, 50,000-acre potato farms where the highly automated, very pesticide-dependent places where so much pesticide is being used to grow your French fries that the farmers can't go outside for 3 days after they spray and operate their farms remote control from bunkers. Every crop circle is on a different computer monitor, and that they grow organic potatoes by the house because these potatoes are so full of pesticide. So, you know, having a first-person experience of the French fries and the potatoes, the Happy Meal, basically, made me realize that this is a story most of us don't know. And as the more you learn about it, the more it changes the way you eat.
I know for me, the Omnivore's Dilemma is what I call a game-changing book. I think that it's had such a profound effect on the population in general because it brought so close to home and was so well written. And you quote Emerson in the book. I just want to throw one quote, which I found to be it was very touching. You've just dined, and however scrupulously the slaughterhouse is concealed in the graceful distance of miles, there is complicity. And, you know, for me, when I read that, it kind of like everything came together, and you start to realize how – well, you write a lot about connection, about how we're all connected, how everything's connected.
And we, you know, we are complicit in the system if we eat from it. And most of us deal with it by not dealing with it.
He says we're connected, but we're completely disconnected. We have no idea.
We have no idea where our food
comes from.
And, you know, the idea of Omnivore's Dilemma, which is a very simple book, it traces four meals back to the land where they grew. You couldn't have written that book 75 years ago. It was too obvious. Everybody knew where their food comes from. Everybody knew a farmer. Everybody had a farmer in their family or was a farmer themselves. Mm-hmm. So that ability to take food and package it in such a way that, you know, kids don't know where chicken nuggets come from. My kid didn't know. You know, I remember there's a scene in the book where I take him to McDonald's. He's begging to go to McDonald's, and they've reformulated the chicken nuggets, and they're like all white meat now, or mostly white meat. And so I say, so how are the new nuggets? And I said, do they taste more like chicken? And he looked at me like, chicken? Dad, they're nuggets. And the connection between this bird and this food, most kids, if you ask them, have no idea.
Wow. Yeah. Although we seem to be moving back, at least in small quantities, toward this understanding, knowing your farm and knowing your farmer, or this farm-to-fork movement, local food movement that we talk a lot about.
Yeah, I think that there is a change in the air, and that there's a great remembering going on of food and where it comes from and what it means and how much it does for us in terms of health and community. And it's just starting, you know, but there is a food movement rising across the country to help people reconnect to food.
But who are the people involved in that food movement, the people who are actively seeking out farmers markets and dealing with directly with farmers in some cases?
It's pretty various, actually. I mean, if you read the media, you would think it's just, you know, affluent people on the coasts. But in my experience, it's popping up everywhere. And you have a urban agriculture movement in the inner city in many places of people who don't have good access to food, growing their own food together in community, you know, projects. You have a farm-to-school movement, which is hooking up local farms with schools, trying mm-hmm. to improve school food, which is a really important project. I mean, we're feeding our kids junk food in schools mostly. We're creating the next generation of fast food eaters. rather than showing kids where food actually comes from. So you have things like the Edible Schoolyard, which is a project that's now national, to have gardens in schools, teach middle schoolers how to grow food and then how to cook it, and then how to sit down and eat it in an actual meal.
What about the people who live in the breadbasket, who actually see how this stuff is grown?
Well, that's the great irony. I mean, some of the worst food deserts in this country sit atop the best soils in the world. I mean, places like Iowa, where you could grow anything. You have 6 feet of gorgeous topsoil. And in general, all the food that is grown there is shipped out, processed, and then shipped back in the form of either fast food or convenience foods. But even in pockets, I haven't been in Iowa in 5 years or so, but there are even pockets in Iowa where you're starting to get farmers, even big corn and bean farmers, taking 10 acres out of their crop, growing for local markets, getting in on the local food deal. So the local food economy is growing very quickly. It's about $7 billion now. That's still a drop in the bucket. But it's growing faster than any other segment of the food industry.
Yeah, we spoke earlier about sort of this idea of disconnection, and I say you write about connection, but really it's like you're either connected to the problem or you're connected to the solution. Mm. And it seems like one of the things that's turned in the last few years is more and more people want to be connected to the solution. And one of my favorite characters that you've written about in all your books, and I'll say, to me, your books kind of follow a progression. They're tied together. There's some themes that recur. But Joel Salatin at Polyface Farms is like this amazing – I'm reading that and I'm feeling very, very hopeful about things. Do people – and he has a farm that integrates, you know, everything so that he leaves the land better than he found it. Are people like this having a huge impact, or are they beginning to have an impact and people following them?
Yes. I mean, Joel Salatin is one of the most influential farmers in the country these days. Mm-hmm. He's quite well known. He goes around the country speaking and giving workshops. Basically, what Joel does, he's in Swope, Virginia, which is in the Shenandoah Valley. And he, for me, too, was a very inspiring character when I met him and spent time. I worked on his farm for like a week and to learn how it worked and visited it 3 or 4 times. And he's basically doing animal agriculture. He's doing hogs, he's doing chicken, he's doing beef and rabbits. And he does it in a very clever way. If you ask him what kind of farmer he is, are you a chicken farmer, a beef farmer, he'll say, no, I'm a grass farmer. I said, grass? You don't sell grass. And he said, but it's the keystone species of the system. And basically what he's done is he's put his cattle on grass, which is what cattle were evolved to eat. They're much healthier on grass, and their meat is much healthier for us if they get a grass diet. And then he lets them graze for a day, and then he moves them out. There's a lot of rotation in this. And then he moves in a portable chicken coop. And the chickens fan out on the pasture where the cattle had been. And they make a beeline for the cow patties, which they start pulling apart to get the grubs, which are the larvae of flies, mm-hmm. which is their favorite food in the world. And that becomes their protein source. And they spread the manure. And they eliminate the fly problem on the farm and produce the most beautiful eggs you've ever had. And then they spend a few days. And then he moves them out. And then he brings in another species. And so basically he's figured out a way to capture solar energy through grass, pass it through the gut of ruminants designed to eat it, and the ruminants then help feed the chickens, and the chickens help fertilize the pasture, and you have this beautifully elegant food chain that is actually, as Peter said, at the end of the year, there's more fertility rather than less. There's more topsoil rather than less. He's sequestering carbon. So anyway, there are ways to do it well that fill people with hope.
I want to come back and ask you why more people aren't doing it that way, because that's really the natural
it's a great
way
question.
To do it. Michael Pavlin is our guest. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFA.
And you're listening to an archive show here on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio. Support this morning comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance journalism excellence in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. It's not too late to support public radio and WFAE in 2013 with a tax-deductible contribution before December 31st. We fell a little short of our $100,000 goal during our one-day December drive, but you can help fill the void and really make your contribution count by calling 704-549-9000 or pledging online at WFAE.org. www.theomnivoresdilemma.org. Cloudy today in Charlotte. We're looking for a high expected around 52 degrees tonight. Cloudy, chance of rain after midnight, and a low near 35.
On the next Diane Rehm show, about 24 million Americans are helping care for aging parents. A journalist's story of how her father's final years led her mother to decide against life-prolonging care.
Tune into the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10, here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Michael Pollan, journalist, author, activist. His new book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Also with us, Peter Reinhardt, our chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales University. You were talking about the farmer up in Virginia, Mr. Saddletan, who has a more natural way of farming. It's more aligned along the lines of exactly what would happen in nature if we just left the system alone. And it works on so many different levels. Why aren't more people doing it? Is it more complicated? Is it more expensive? Is it less productive? What's the deal?
Well, it's a good question. It's actually more productive. I mean, he gets more food off of his he's got about 500 acres, 100 open, and 400 are just forest, than any comparable farm. I mean, huge amounts of meat come off this farm. So it's not productivity. It's a couple things. One is it's labor intensive. You've got to move those cattle and those chickens every day. And we have gotten into a mode of farming in this country where we've reduced the amount of labor in it, replacing it with technology, essentially. And many farmers, to support their farms, can't be on the farm every day. They're driving trucks. They're, you know, they've got jobs in town working in the healthcare system. And so we've automated farming. I mean, you know, the average person growing corn and soybeans in the Midwest is working about 5 or 6 weeks full-time a year to do that. It's driving tractors and spraying. And so a kind of farming that requires you to be on the farm all the time, skip your couple months in Florida, which a lot of farmers in the Midwest do, is not appealing to a lot of farmers. It also requires, though, a lot more knowledge. I mean, Joel's got 5 or 6 different species of animals. He has to know about each species. He can't specialize. He has to be a generalist. And most of our farmers are highly specialized. Mm-hmm. You get them away from corn and beans or hogs, if that's what they do, or cattle, and they're lost. So you need to be a very intellectually curious, adventurous farmer to do this. But I would say the biggest impediment is that we have a subsidy system that locks people into the system they're farming now. And we reward farmers for maximizing production of corn and soy, which is, you know, usually animal feed that's fed to farm to cattle on feedlots or in these highly industrialized chicken and hog operations. So, you know, if we started rewarding farmers for taking annual agriculture, which is a huge environmental problem because of the erosion and things, and put their land back, some of their land back into perennial polyculture, which is to say grass, and encourage them to put animals on that grass, reward them for things like sequestering carbon, which we now can measure, you would see a lot of farmers, I think, not everybody, but a lot of farmers moving to this kind of system. And the benefits, both for the environment and for our health, would be huge. But, you know, our subsidy system stands in the way of any kind of innovation or change in agriculture.
So this is really literally a grassroots movement. But from what I've been reading recently, because Omnivore's Dilemma came out 7-8 years ago, so much has changed since then. And I'd love to get your take on how much has changed. But really, there is movement, it seems like, in
well, there's
grass
a market,
farming.
Too. Yeah, there is a market now for grass-fed meat, grass-finished meat that did not exist in, you know, 10 years ago. And you can find it. I was in Philadelphia and someone there was saying, oh, I get it all the time and I get it in my supermarket. I think it's going to become a much bigger product category, and that's a very encouraging development. Pastured eggs now you can find in many places. They're expensive, but they're spectacular. And so grass farming is taking off, and it's a wonderful thing to see. And Joel is one of the avatars of it. I mean, he's really kind of...
Are you responsible in some way for this? Because it wasn't your first big splash in food writing, the anatomy of a cow or the biography
That's right.
Biography
yeah.
of a cow.
Power Steer. Well, I think that that book helped. I mean, I hear from a lot of ranchers who are doing grass farming that when that book came out, people started asking for it. When that article came out, that was 2002, and there were three paragraphs about grass-fed beef in that. And the whole rest of the article was all about industrial beef. And I always feel in my work, it's very important if there is a good solution out there to not just discuss the problems. I think that's a problem of a lot of journalism. We only talk about problems. But in this case, there was a very interesting, even if small, solution on offer. And I talked about it, and I insisted on keeping those three paragraphs in the article. And they were at the end of an 8,000-word article. So for me, my literary vanity was, of course, flattered by the fact that people got to the end.
Do we have enough grassland in America left today so that we could raise cattle using grass as opposed to corn on the scale that we need to feed the country and the rest of the world for that?
Well, that's a key question. If you were to convert the percentage of the farm belt that is now growing corn and soy to feed cattle, which is probably 30-40% of it, and you were feeding cattle on that, could you raise as much cattle? And I don't know the answer to that, and I would guess probably not. I think you would have to shrink your beef agriculture, and beef would be what it was not too long ago, which is something that was a little bit more of a special occasion and a little bit more expensive. The main reason, though, is that it takes longer to finish an animal on grass. If you're putting them on a feedlot and you're giving them not just corn but hormones to make them grow quickly, and antibiotics to keep them healthy, you can get a cow to slaughter weight in 13-14 months. And that's an efficiency, but it has an enormous cost. If you want to finish them on grass, you can get plenty of food off that meadow, as much energy off that meadow as you can had you planted it in corn, in fact, which is hard to believe. But when you plant a land in corn, you're really only harvesting solar energy for 3 or 4 months. Whereas if it's grass, you're getting many more months out of it. And you could be getting 12 months, depending on where you are in the country. But you can't finish the animal. It takes at least 20 months and usually 24 months. And time is money. And I think that's the main thing that stands in the way. But, you know, feeding the world is the argument often used to undermine sustainable agriculture. The industrial agriculture is the only way we can feed the world in the coming 10 billion. I think that question is not settled, in fact. And I think there are a lot of presumptions built into that question. One is that, what do we want to feed the world? Do we want to feed the world 9 ounces of beef per person per day? Well, we can't do that. I mean, there's just not enough world. We'd need another two worlds.
Well, in your opinion, I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, we eat too much meat. That meat has become the focal point of the meal, and it really ought to be a side dish and not necessarily at every meal.
Yeah, we do eat too much meat. I mean, it's unsustainable. And now that the Chinese have decided they want to eat as much meat as we do, that's going to be a tremendous problem. And in fact, what is bringing down the rainforest right now is the need to plant soy to feed animals living in China.
Well, how did we get here? Is it simply because America had all this land and we had cattle ranches and the cowboys of the Wild West, and you had Delmonico's Steakhouse in New York City where they put this 20-ounce slab of beef on your plate, and by gosh, that's America.
Meat is prestigious. I mean, in every culture, meat is special. It's wonderful. People love meat. Hunters work very hard to get it in hunter-gatherer societies, and they celebrate when they get it. Ceremony is always attached to the eating of meat. It's true in barbecue, and it's been true for thousands of years. It's a very, you know, high calorie, very nutritious food. So as people have gotten wealthier, they have wanted to eat more meat. Mm-hmm. We took this to a whole new level when we developed our fast food industry. That is really what democratized meat in this country and made it possible to have meat at three meals a day. I mean, that's what McDonald's is offering people. And the way we did it was very energy intensive. It contributes enormously to climate change in several different ways. I mean, when you know your carbon footprint as a meat eater is about 40% higher than it would be if you were a vegetarian. And the reason is that it takes fossil fuel energy to grow the corn to feed the cattle. The cattle themselves put out lots of methane, which is a very serious greenhouse gas. And then the moving them around and the transportation and the waste. It takes 10 pounds of corn to make 1 pound of beef. So it's a very inefficient way
How
to eat.
How many pounds of grass does it take?
No one's ever counted it up.
Okay.
I mean,
the grass keeps coming back.
Yeah, it's renewable. There are figures for how many cow days you can get on a pasture, and it depends on what your rainfall is and what part of the country you live in. But I don't know those numbers.
But for me, the big takeaway, is, especially from omnivores, where you really dig deep into this system, into this faulty system, is that it's not sustainable. I mean, the intentions are good. We're trying to feed the world. That's always the dilemma. The population's growing, and yet we create these systems that require a tremendous investment of resources that are not sustainable. They're not renewable. And eventually, it's like Koyaanisqatsi. It's a world out of control. Sooner or later, it all has to come kind of spinning apart.
Yeah, I mean, when we say industrial agriculture can feed the world, one of the things we have to look at, for how long? I mean, it's basically bankrupting the soil. It's mining the soil. And it is, you know, filling the environment with pollution and greenhouse gases. I mean, downstream of these feedlots, you know, the fish are turning into are not just being killed; they're having their sexes changed, and the frogs because of all the hormones that are in the food. We don't know what they're doing to us. And there's this public health problem, which we haven't talked about around food. We have a public health crisis related to overeating and the kinds of food we're eating. So, and when you talk about feeding the world, too, we have to remember that even with all the food we're producing about, I've read, between 4,000 and 5,000 calories of food worldwide per person. You only need 2,000. So what's going on with all those extra calories? We still have 1 billion people hungry.
Is that, why is that?
Well, there's a couple places. A lot of those calories go to feed cattle. So we're losing a lot of those calories, the 10-to-1 ratio that goes into making meat. A lot of those calories now go to feed our cars, okay? We're taking about 20% of the calories we're growing, and we're making ethanol with it. So that's not feeding anybody.
And we're doing that to subsidize the farmers, giving them a reason
to grow basically. More corn. And, you know, we think it's a green energy source.
Is it?
No, it's not. It takes so much energy to make a gallon of ethanol that you it's a wash, or you get a little bit, depending on whose figures you believe.
And so why are we doing this?
Well, it began as a way to subsidize farmers, keep the corn prices up when they were low. We had a mandate that you had to put 10% ethanol in a mixture of gasoline, and that led to this whole industry. And then we thought it was a green technology, and we keep thinking it will become green when we can make it out of something other than corn, when we can make it out of cellulose, make it out of the corn stalk instead of the kernels. So a lot of the food is going into the cars, and then we waste between 30% and 40% of it. So there is plenty of food around. We just have to figure out a smarter way to divide the pie.
Well, there must be plenty of food around because we have this obesity epidemic that you alluded to. Do you have a theory as to why there are so many fat people in America? When I was growing up, there were very few.
Yeah, well, you know, there are many, many reasons. And we've changed the way we eat. We don't eat at meals. We don't have family meals anymore. We snack. We eat on the run. We don't cook. There is a very tight correlation between the decline in home cooking and the rise in obesity. And why is that? Well, when we outsource our cooking to corporations, it turns out they don't do a very good job. There's something about the way humans cook that is very special. When corporations cook, they tend to use the cheapest possible raw ingredients and dress them up with as much salt, fat, and sugar as they possibly can, because those three ingredients are incredibly appealing. Mm-hmm. Any chef knows this.
Yep.
But they're very cheap to add to food, but they're not very good for us.
Now, Peter, I believe you have formulated products for industrial packaged foods.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, I've worked with some companies that
okay,
do.
Okay, yeah. So when you work with those companies, did they give you instruction on what you had to do, to what kind of ingredients you could start with and what you had to do to make it attractive so people would buy it?
Fortunately for me, because my focus is on doughs and things, I tend to work with companies that are already more leaning towards ecologically sound practices. They're companies that do natural foods or whatever. I have done creative projects for some of the larger companies where there's no parameters, but they don't ask me to work with ingredients that are the weird ones that you see on the label, they want basically flavor. And then what happens is we create, the creative people come up with the flavor profile. Then they take them back into R&D, the companies that are more in the industrial side of things. And they find ways to do it, as Michael was saying, cheaper and with ingredients that maybe aren't the same flavor sources as I gave them, but reproduce those same flavors through chemicals and things like that.
So if I understand this correctly, you blame a lot of the problems that we have with food, from obesity to just bad nutrition to problems with the atmosphere and too many pesticides, et cetera. You blame politicians, bureaucrats in the USDA, Street capitalists, agricultural conglomerates, and you say they've wreaked havoc.
You must be on somebody's hit list, I got to tell you.
Everybody's to blame. But they've wreaked havoc upon the diet, nutrition, and the well-being of Americans, you say.
Yeah, I don't know where I said that, but I subscribe to that. But, I mean, we're, you know, again, we are complicit ourselves. I mean, we're lazy and we're cheap. And if someone is willing to put a meal that's superficially appealing in front of us for a couple bucks, we will go for it. We would rather, we spend more time watching other people cook on television, on the Food Network, than we spend cooking ourselves. We'd rather be in the chair watching them cook than do it ourselves.
Yeah.
So we're responsible, too.
How do you explain that? Are we longing for somebody to feed us that way, but we're just not going to take the time so we'll watch somebody do it on TV? You can't even smell it.
There, I know. And you can't eat it, by the way. None of that food you get to eat. You just watch it being made, and you watch other people enjoy it. It's bizarre.
Some kind of vicarious thrills.
Yeah, it is vicarious. I call it the cooking paradox. And there are a couple reasons for it. I mean, one is we're tired. You know, we have so many couples where both people work, and we work many of us work more than one job. And so when we get home from work, we are maybe a little too tired to cook. And there are these alternatives, and they're very tempting. So I think that that's part of it.
Could you do processed foods and
that were healthy?
And frozen foods that are healthy, truly healthy?
Well,
and are there any?
First of all, frozen foods can be and are healthy. I mean, people in this celebration of fresh local food, we overlook the fact that simple frozen vegetables, not with the, you know, the little onions and cream sauce and things, but the frozen spinach, the frozen broccoli, these are great products, and they put very healthy food in reach of a lot of people, and so we shouldn't disdain those. The whole meals, what are called home meal replacements, mm-hmm. It's a beautiful industry term for all those things in the supermarket aisle you were describing earlier, could those be made healthy? I think that that's a real question and a real challenge. It's possible. The incentives aren't there. You know, we talk about the industry.
So none of them are healthy. Even the ones
No. I'm sure you could find some that are.
I work for clients who I believe put out very healthy food with no artificial ingredients, no preservatives, no excess sugar and salt, and so it can be done. And there's a market for it, but it's a niche market, but it's a growing market, I think.
And the companies will tell you that the more we formulate for health, our sales go down. People like salt, fat, and sugar. Many people are addicted to them in one way or another. So, you know, it's an interesting challenge. McDonald's now says that they want to do healthy entrees. They're going to do wraps, you know, that they're doing wraps that they say are more healthy. You look closely and the nutritional benefits are not really there.
Well, I want to get into that when we come back, too, because you talk about the nutritionizing of food as opposed to just eating food as food. And that's
that's a trap, too.
Yeah, we're going to come back with Michael Pollan and Peter Reinhardt, and we'll talk about cooking and this book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hope you're enjoying the programming. You're listening to Charlotte Talks. This is an archived version here at 90.7 WFAE listener-funded public radio. Where support this morning comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway, Audi Truth in Engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. About 24 million Americans are helping care for aging parents. One woman's story of how her father's final years led her mother to defy the medical system and meet death on her own terms. That's coming up on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. Cloudy today in Charlotte, a high expected around 52 degrees tonight. Mostly cloudy with a chance of rain after midnight and a low around 35. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Amy Rogers, editor of WFAE's food blog, WFA Eats, a great place to find new ideas and recipes to try on family and friends. Keep us in mind as you plan your next gathering. And be sure to listen for more great food and cooking tips on The Splendid Table and America's Test Kitchen, weekend afternoons at 3 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Michael Pollan is our guest, journalist, author, activist, professor of journalism at UC Berkeley, graduate school of journalism, and the author of many books on food. And his latest one is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Peter Reinhardt from Johnson & Wales, our chef on assignment, is also with us. The nutritionizing of food. You say we have intellectualized and broken down our food into nutrient components, but it has not led to better health. It was supposed to, right?
Yeah, it was. And it was very well intentioned on some people's part. You know, nutrition science, which is something I really got into in depth in the book after Omnivore's Dilemma, In Defense of Food, is a, let me be charitable, it's a very young science. We basically don't understand very much about how nutrition and digestion works. And so we think we figured it out. We all, you know, we thought we figured out that fat was the problem back in the 70s. That the reason we had such high incidence of heart disease in this country and obesity was because we were eating too much saturated fat.
And you mentioned snack wells being developed around that.
Well, there's
time.
A great example of the,
and I used this to goes, buy these products.
I did too.
I thought, there's no fat, I'm eating them.
You know, and if one cookie is so good for you, a whole box
that's
had to be
exactly
better.
Right.
See, that's the trap. As soon as you put a health claim on a food, and the industry knows this very well, even if it's more healthy than another food, people will gorge on it. It becomes a license to eat too much. And so as we see the processed food industry start promoting health, what they're really promoting is overconsumption of marginally better foods. In the case of the fat-free products, however, they weren't even healthier, as it turned out, because fat wasn't really the problem. And that science was really dicey. Your cardiologist probably hasn't told you this yet, but saturated fat has not been linked to heart disease. It's been linked to cholesterol, which has not itself been linked to heart disease as a causal factor. So we have been living in this illusion about, you know, fat-free food, and we've tried very hard to eliminate fat from the diet. But we have replaced it with something. Every time you eliminate something, you have to put something else in. So what did those snack wells have? They had more sugar. They had more salt to make up for the fact that, God, there's the fat's missing. You need fat for food to taste good. Mm-hmm. Fat is also more filling. Here's a curious example. I mean, we also took the fat out of milk, right? Nobody drinks whole milk anymore, which is really a shame. Mm-hmm. But people who switch from whole to skim milk lose no weight. How could that be? Well, they drink more because it's not as filling. And milk, skim milk, has lots of sugar in it. It has lactose.
Yeah, skim milk actually is way worse for somebody with, say, diabetes.
That's
it
right.
It spikes your blood sugar like crazy compared to whole milk, which kind of burns a little bit smoother.
Yeah, exactly. So this well-intentioned effort to get us off of fat happens to coincide with the obesity epidemic. So we got onto a low-fat diet, a lower-fat diet, and we got really fat. And the reason was we binged on carbohydrates, which were innocent foods. You know, that's what you were supposed to eat when the low-fat campaign began. So our this national project of figuring out the good nutrient and the evil nutrient that we've been embarked on for the last few decades has been a disaster. It really is not what food is about. Food is food. It's not nutrients. And nutrients, a food is much more than the sum of its nutrient parts.
So this gets us back to the basics that you were talking about with regard to farming. It also works in regard to eating because you have a mantra. I've called it a mantra. Eat food,
right?
Not too much, mostly plants.
That's all you need to know about nutrition. Really, if you can follow those seven words, you'll be fine. And you don't have to count calories, and you don't have to know about your cholesterol. But the hard part is, they're all hard parts. Eat food? Well, isn't it all food? I'm saying it's not. I'm saying there are a lot of products in the market that we should not dignify with that word.
So I want to get to the edible
food-like substances
that you talk about, because that's what we're eating, a lot of us, and a lot of it.
That's what a lot of processed food is.
So what exactly are we talking about here?
Well, edible food-like substances, you can divide them in many ways, but they're foods that your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. They're foods that have lots of ingredients that haven't been part of the American diet for more than, 30 or 40 years. So one of my rules is, if your third grader can't pronounce the ingredients in a food, it's not real food. If it's got more than five ingredients, not in a recipe, but on the package label, it's an edible food like substance. I have a whole bunch of rules that I laid out in food rules.
So if you buy a box of even healthy, so-called healthy breakfast cereal, and you look at the list of ingredients, it takes the whole side of the box in very fine print.
Well, that's another rule. Don't eat any cereals that change the color of the milk. And then you don't even have to read the label.
But almost. And the originators of cereal, like Mr. Kellogg and Mr. Post,
Who,
they were health food advocates. They wouldn't recognize cereal today. I mean,
no, it was a much simpler product. Yeah. And there still are. I mean, there's oatmeal, remember. That has one ingredient. It's a wonderful food. And many of us feel that's too difficult to make. So then we came up with breakfast cereals where you just took them out of the box, poured milk over it. But even those now are too difficult to make, and we've reduced them to bars with synthetic milk, stripes on them. So we've processed food in the interest of convenience, in the interest of shelf life, but fundamentally not in the interest of health.
So eat only what your grandmother would recognize as food, and then you say avoid food products that come bearing health claims.
Yeah, now that sounds counterintuitive. But think about it. For a food to carry a health claim on its package, it needs a package. Okay, that's first fact.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be fresh food. For a company to get a health claim approved, because you do have to have some science or pseudoscience at least to back it up, you need a big budget. You need a big marketing budget to get the word out. So only the biggest corporations can do the work that it takes to get a health claim. Go to the produce aisle. All that stuff is incredibly quiet. It has nothing to say, but that's the really healthy food. Because the broccoli growers can't afford the health claims and don't have the packages to put them on. And so the healthiest food in the supermarket is the quietest.
Which brings us kind of to cooked, because you've taken us through all of your books kind of down into the darkness, so to speak, and what the problems are. But now with Cooked, I kind of feel like this is the book of it's about transformation. You talk about that word, which is very powerful. We've talked about cooking as an act of transformation. And this seems like this is sort of the way out or a way.
Well, towards. I think it is for a lot of people. I mean, look, we have to deal with the crisis around food, the public health crisis, in many ways. We need changes in policy. We need to encourage farmers to grow real food. But finally, it's not going to work unless we buy real food, which is to say, learn how to prepare it. And I've been working on the food chain now for, a dozen years at least, studying the food chain. And one of the most striking things I've learned is that the problem on the farm is a cooking problem, and the problem in our diet is a cooking problem. In other words, this new local food movement, exciting as it is, as hopeful as it is going to top out if people aren't willing to buy raw ingredients from farmers and go to farmers' markets. Because if you're buying your food and it's all going to be cooked by corporations, they're only going to buy from the biggest monoculture farmers. So we need to cook to support the food movement. But we, more importantly, we need to cook to support our health. It is really the easiest way to improve your diet.
Because,
not to say it's
because
easy.
Because you control the ingredients?
It's the only way to take back control of your diet. If you're leaving it in the hands of experts or you're leaving it in the hands of corporations, you're going to have problems.
But a lot of people watched Julia Child for years on public television, who just ladened everything with butter because she was a French cook. That couldn't have been healthy.
Well, actually, it turns out it was. Compared to margarine, margarine, butter, we worried would give people heart attacks. Margarine actually did, because it was full of trans fats. And that is the one fat we have learned reliably gets you sick. So Julia Child was probably not far off. I mean, that was probably healthier food than many of the things that replaced it. But I'm not talking about Julia Child level food. I'm talking about everyday home cooking, the kinds of simple things you can put on the table
like
in a half hour.
Like? Because time is of the essence.
Time is of the essence. I know people are in a panic about time. Although I encourage everybody to really look at how they're spending time and see. I mean, if you are spending an hour watching the Food Network, take a half hour of that back for some actual cooking,
or cook with them,
or cook alongside.
But you're in Cooked, which is really about this act of cooking. You really give only four recipes. They sort of represent categories of cooking,
and they're not easy recipes. I hasten to add. It is a book to reconnect you to cooking and what it's about, but it's not a book of 20-minute recipes. There are plenty of those on the market, and I encourage people to find them. But it's really to help people see, again, what a beautiful process it is. This thing we regard as drudgery actually can be a great pleasure. Even the dicing of an onion, which I hated when I went into this process, because everything you make, you've got to start with dicing an onion just about. Even that, approached in the right spirit, can be satisfying and fun.
How so?
Well, first you have to get your technique down. There's a way to cut an onion so you can minimize the amount of tears. But isn't that interesting that this plant makes you cry? What is that about? So learning about it, it's a defense. This is a plant that fights back. It came up with this because the teeth of a rodent that might eat it, they wanted to poison that rodent. So they've come up with this tear gas, and it's a very clever system, and I explain how it works. And so the more you know about the science of cooking, the more interesting it becomes.
So that's when you say they, meaning the species of onions.
Yes.
So, as if the onions have this sort of consciousness, and that's a recurrent theme in your books.
It is.
You take the point of view of the plants very often.
I have enormous respect for plants.
Look at the world through the plant's eyes rather than through our – we think we're controlling it, and you posit that sometimes it's the plants that are controlling us.
Well, yeah, we're manipulated by plants all the time. I mean, it isn't clear. We've taken our country and made it corn wall to wall. And is that serving us or is that serving corn? And I think very often it's serving corn more than us. So we're definitely manipulated by plants all the time. But that's kind of a side issue. So this is a book that to get you excited about cooking again and inspired and to realize that there's a lot at stake in the kitchen.
But a lot of people have forgotten or never learned.
The skills are lost.
How to cook, particularly from scratch. And they'll never go back.
We have a generation whose parents perhaps didn't cook and didn't teach them. And that's one of the reasons I think we need to teach cooking in schools. We did once. Remember, there was home ec.
Right, home ec.
But there were problems with home ec. One was only girls took it. Mm-hmm. As a boy, I took shop. I learned how to make a Japanese lamp. I wish I had taken home ec and learned something valuable. So we need a non-gendered home ec. I think, Jamie Oliver has the right idea. You shouldn't be able to graduate school. We should not send our kids out into the world without knowing 10 basic recipes. These are really critical life skills. This is a better predictor of your future health than anything else, is knowing how to cook, and cooking several nights a week.
Wow. Which comes back to this other theme we've talked about today, this sense of connection, because what you're really teaching people to do is, and when people have read your earlier books, they say, if I've read Omnivore's Dilemma, I'm never going to look at the food the same way again because of what you've taken us through. Same thing with Cooked. Once you know how – it's a new way of looking at cooking that can transform us. It's not just about transforming the food, but there's a transformational process that happens as we connect with the process. Isn't that kind of what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, and I use the word transformation with us in mind too. Because if you cook there are all these ripples that come from it. If you cook, you're going to have your family sit down to a meal. You're not going to cook for yourself. It's a social act. It's a giving. And one of the problems with food is we're eating on the run and alone too much. We're losing the social dimension of food, which is, I think, the most important. Think about what happens at the family table. This is where I say in the book that family dinner is the nursery of democracy. Okay, there's a politics to it. Think about what you learn there. You learn how to share. You learn how to take turns. You learn how to argue without fighting. Really critical skills.
And you listen to other ideas.
That's right. And you listen to other ideas. And we don't get a lot of that in our society. We're in front of screens all the time.
Right.
We fight through screens. And it's no wonder that we've had a coarsening of our civil discourse in this country. So cooking leads to sitting down to meals, and meals are just one of the most important institutions in our country.
Very quickly, let me go through some things that have come in over the transom as we've been talking. Andy on Twitter, my four-year-old's first encounter with a chicken wing. Ooh, Daddy, my nugget has a bone in it. Denise in Concord emails, what do you think about the paleo diet, which suggests that humans have not been eating grain and dairy long enough to be fully adapted to these two foods? Many of these health problems may be arising because of our overconsumption of processed and unprocessed carbohydrates.
You know, the paleo diet's very interesting. The premise is that we haven't evolved in the last... We've had agriculture only for 10,000 years. Our bodies are adapted to a hunter-gatherer diet. And there is some truth to that. However, we have changed in 10,000 years. Digesting milk as an adult is a relatively new thing. Mm-hmm. Some people are lactose intolerant, but many are not. We've evolved new enzymes to help us digest grain. So I think it's kind of an extreme idea. I think that... Do we have too much grain in our diet and too much milk products? Probably. But you can't go back. I mean, the meat that the hunter-gatherer ate is not the meat that's coming out of your supermarket now. Because the animals have had their diet change also. So I think turning back the clock is not realistic.
We have a caller we can't take because we have 30 seconds left, and he wants to know about food and allergies. They seem to be on the rise.
Yeah, I talk about that in Cooked, and something is going on, and it probably has to do with our immune system, mm-hmm. and the fact that we're not exposed to enough bacteria as children, and we don't get enough live culture food, which is to say things like sauerkraut and kimchi in our diets, with the result that our immune systems have gone haywire and they're confusing friend and foe. So they attack, say, something like, some peanuts, which mm-hmm. is a food.
Mm-hmm. Michael Pollan, author of Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, and several other books on food. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it. And Peter Reinhart, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bring on the pizza.